So, what we want to do today is further explore the distinction between a rights-based model and a duties-based model that Friedman, that we started last class. The central idea that we came out of this, that came out of last class, that Friedman argued, is that in a rights model, there's of necessity, a rights model doesn't leave room for any conversation about the substantive issue. Right? In a rights model, the conversation is about who gets to decide, and once that person gets to decide, they have no obligation, they have no duty to engage in conversation with the other people involved, because it's their decision, not anybody else's, and nobody else has any right to know. And it's just the one right to make the decision. And we argue that really what an ethics consultation in that context is a cut-rate lawsuit. Right? Oh. Right? You don't want to go to court to figure out who gets to make the decision, so you're right to try and have the ethics clarified for you. The only issue on the table ethically is autonomy, and the question is whose autonomy is most involved, and whoever's autonomy is most involved gets to make the decision.
But it's not on black and white, so there isn't that someone has the right and someone does not have the right. There's also like someone has the right and they do not have the right to make the decision. Like there isn't just black and white. There's black and white and some gray and then
there's a whole box of crayons.
All right, so I was thinking is that if you frame it in terms of autonomy, right, so autonomy is a right to make your own regulations. Autonomy never creates a right to influence anybody else. So right, once somebody has a right to make the decision, there's no need to regard anybody else. Right, you're not infringing on their right. They can speak, but who's to listen?
So what about your example of the doctor's right to care for the patient, and that's what you're talking about, that is autonomy. So in fact, his autonomy is infringing.
So we would probably say no, the doctor doesn't have a right to cure the patient. The doctor has a right not to be forced to do things they don't want to do, perhaps.
Doctor has the obligation to
deal
with the patient, right?
Doctor doesn't have a duty. Doctor has a right. Doctor doesn't have a right to behave in accordance with his conscience. Right? That's where it comes. Doctor has a right to behave in accordance with his conscience or her conscience. And you have a right to make this. So we just clash and say, well, you know, what is my body? All right. So then my autonomy is your autonomy. Right? Now again, once we've decided that, then who cares what the doctor wants? And that's his model. And again, it can be modified. I can be modified, but I think that as a base model, it's not a bad beginning for discussion to claim that rights essentially are solely issues of priority. There's no real issue of mediation, there's no joint venture. My rights are always going to be in conflict with yours. And he argued as opposed to a duty model where essentially, we start off with the premise that there is no conflict because all of us start off with the premise that we should do our duty.
Right, and you're
discussing
my duty, then
there shouldn't be any need for conflict. Right? That's the argument. The duty-based model, right, there's no reason. Well, there might be conflict if we come to different conceptions of duty. But we all have an interest in the conversation. We all have an interest in the conversation because we're all trying to figure out the same thing, right? About what we all want to do, what the right thing to do in this case is.
Mario, we'll please come to the main office. Thank you.
Yes, that is.
So,
So Friedman argues, and Friedman's argument is A, he thinks duty is better. B, he thinks that Judaism is largely duty. C, he thinks that the Jewish conception of duty is helpful for people who don't who aren't Jewish. Okay, those are the three moves that he makes, he thinks that of those three models, right, rights, consultation, duty, he thinks that duty has many advantages. Okay, because, one major advantage of it is that it creates a motive for a conversation among all the people involved, as opposed to pitting them against each other. He said that one advantage of a duty model is that it creates a motive for all the people involved to talk about what should happen, as opposed to pitting them against each other, and to have a shared interest. And the conversation should begin on the premise that everybody, that if we clarify the situation, everyone will want the same thing. As opposed to a rights model, where we start on the premise that everyone wants different things, and our job is to figure out who wins. Okay, so that's the stage one. That's a major advantage of the duty-based model, is that it gives you a basis, a motive, and a rationale for keeping everybody who has an interest in the conversation. Okay, again, the rights model, once you decide who the decision is, they just throw everybody else out of the room. Okay, that's move number one. Secondly, guess what? A duty-based model has advantages, and Judaism is a duty-based model. Okay? In particular, halakha is right, and the other thing is Judaism is halakha, but you can have halakha about rights also, right? We have a Bill of Rights, that's halakha, that's American halakha, but it's all about rights. We happen to have halakha, which is about duty, as opposed to about rights. Yes, John?
So I think, basically, more on what's right for the person, regardless of what they want. But if it's based on rights, it depends on who is making the call, whether it's duty, it depends on what would be better for the person in the long run.
Yeah, well, what is better to do, not better for the person necessarily,
what is better to do. All right?
In a duty-based model, what a person wants is never, is not any reason to do anything. That you want it is not a reason to do it, is not a reason to do it. And a duty-based model, we're interested in what you should want, not what you do want. As a rights-based model, we're interested in the fact that you want it is reason enough to do it. Okay, yes, sir.
So you could say that duty-based model is a way of keeping, making sure that people's duties, or what they think their duties are, match up better.
Okay.
Or are more in line.
Yeah, doing it as a way of educating people towards the proper perception of their duty.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a perfectly reasonable formulation of halakha. Yes, Abby.
For duty, there's no, they thought this was being that's healthiest for you, but, between the doctor and the patient, there's not, neither one is, what you should do.
Well, that depends, right? So people would argue that Judaism sets up a set of obligations towards
the patient. Does Judaism argue that the doctor shouldn't do?
Yes, he's just telling you that there are a set of duties towards the self, which you then have to figure out.
It looks like it's ever possible, in some situations, to come up with.
Doesn't even have a clear answer. You can have a conversation, right? If the only conversation is whose body is it? Is your body? Then the doctor.
You can have a conversation, but
then only that people are not but this way, if the doctor in a duty-based model, right? So the doctor and the patient are both have an interest in figuring out what the right thing to do is. And if they start off with conflicting conceptions, right, so they're talking, right, so they're talking to each other. I think you owe a duty to this, that you share with me that you want it. You should listen to me. Because you want to do your duty, and I'm telling you. In the rights-based model, all I can tell you is I don't think you should be allowed to make that decision. I should be allowed to make that decision. I'm not interested.
Okay.
Right? So let's just talk to each other. Yes, this is.
So all three models can be applied to any
case involving two people or involving a discussion about
sure.
itself, but he's saying that the one that should be applied is the model.
Okay, the duty model is often a superior model.
Let's allow this example for Americans. Like, are taxes a duty? People have to pay them, but then you...
Sure, taxes, right? So taxes are a duty, but one of the really interesting questions, like one of the ways in which we've moved is we no longer see military service as a duty. Right? And that's the big shift.
The draft has been
reinstated. Whether or not we also have a draft
is a voluntary, though. It's not even an obligation, is it?
No, it's not a duty, right? We don't treat that.
We treat that now as a duty and an obligation.
Sure. Not for our purposes, no. Freeman talks about the possibility that we don't really distinguish that.
What defines the duty? Is there certain things that you should do, but and if you don't do them, then you'll...
So we'll get there.
They're not responsible duties.
But we'll get there. But I think one of the critiques of contemporary American society that people often offer is that American society has become so completely right-based that the notion of duty is foreign. Right? So this is right. So right, getting rid of the draft has a huge cultural impact.
Healthcare
plan. Well, how can you not fill it out when you say that? You have to register, and every once in a while, right? Senator Rangel from New York, every once in a while, raises the possibility of revising the draft. And as I mentioned, I have deep moral problems with an all-volunteer army. And sure, one of the fights I lost from the hill was I wanted to put in an Anisha Barrett for the American Army that specifically focused on the volunteer nature and wanted people to recognize that other people were fulfilling their duty for them. Right? So the volunteer army is a situation where you're essentially paying other people to fulfill your duty. And that makes me deeply queasy. Morally. Much as, as a parent, of course, I'm quite happy that there's no draft. As a philosopher, I think very unhappy.
If we're obligated to fight, then we're not necessarily going
to... you're talking about pragmatically, sometimes you better do that. But in principle, American culture, especially, some people would argue, Northeast liberal American culture, has a really difficult time with the notion of civic duty. And it plays out, culturally, let's say, what people's reaction to jury duty is.
It's kind of like something if you think about a doctor, if a doctor has to become a lawyer through pro bono, and the doctor has to do basically pro bono work, then they're not going to be, they're not going to get into the treatment, they're not going to be part of the thing, they don't want to
do it.
How does that has to see patients that,
a lot, the standard Jewish tradition based on the Bible is opposed to your Shalmi is behold the Golem of Kuvenoth, the Shayim of Kuvenoth, or you think that there is an added virtue to doing something as a fulfillment of duty, as opposed to voluntary. But we recognize, Tosfos says, that the reason that you're greater is because there's a stronger, or there's an urge to flee, which doesn't exist if you're voluntary. And I think it's complicated, I live a life that is, circumscribed to Allah and that creates large measures of duty, and then I also, I also feel duties that develop upon me as a rabbi, and one of the, as the right on the previous case, that's part of why I'm moving to Sharon. part of the issue is that because I was a rabbi in Cambridge's parable, I had a whole set of duties that evolved on me. And once I left the position, I still had those relationships, and it became impossible for me to break those, and I just made life hard in the community. And you're stuck with a whole set of duties that you're no longer being paid for. Like one of the things I'm celebrating is that I no longer have to take it, as of Wednesday, I will no longer be responsible for the Cambridge Summer Lawyers. And that is a huge burden off my shoulders, both because it means I don't have to spend my Friday afternoon everyone else is getting ready to desperately reconstruct the elements of my error, and because it just means that I don't have to have this weight on my shoulder that if I do something, then everybody's carrying on Shabbat against Halakha. I'm really glad not to have that. Really, really, I'm really
part of it. Like, really tell them. Should we tell them?
I told them that other day. Yeah, we pledged donations to them. You know, to the rabbi funded. You know, we took over here. I still wanted to get rid of it. But I couldn't leave the community without arrows, you know, because I had that position. I created it when I was in that position, and Van Hill didn't hire anybody to replace me, or the hire someone to replace me didn't see it as part of the job. So.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's really responsible for all shit.
No, thank God.
Tremendous literary.
Okay, so that's one topic. So move one is that Judaism is then. Move two is that Judaism is a Judaism-based system. And move three, and this I think is the most important contribution Friedman's book made generally, is he says that Judaism is not just an example of a Judaism-based system which is relevant for Jews, but has nothing to say to non-Jews. But Judaism is an example, is a Judaism-based system which is a useful model for everybody. And the Judaism writes that
Judaism is
a Judaism-based system that is useful for everybody. Right? That the Jewish conversation about these issues is universally relevant. Okay, so he's making the claim, right, so that Jewish ethics are universal. In terms of opening conversation. But you can frame it that way.
Oh, wait.
Yes.
Oh, wait, okay. I need to break this down, and
all right.
And then, thank you.
It's a good model.
What?
Universal, useful.
Useful.
That was a word.
I couldn't think of another word.
Okay. So, bringing it from back to the beginning of the year.
Yes.
At the beginning of the year, okay. When you sent us the article about healthcare and how you weren't Jewish, whether or not it would relate to us, so I think that relates to that argument.
Absolutely.
Because I think the majority of us said that if we weren't Jewish, that it probably wouldn't really relate. And we wouldn't have gotten the same thing out of it. We wouldn't have felt an obligation, I guess. And so I guess that contradicts his argument.
Sure. So Friedman's going to try and convince you that all of you instinctively took the position that when you read the specific audience to me, I'd say it was a fascinating experience when I tell people that reflect on regularly, that the way in which it was a good challenge to my biases, because I tend to think of the Reform movement as usually couching arguments that are explicitly universal and has very little specific Jewish content about them,
mm-hmm.
and the entire class gets up and says that the arguments on the Reform movement site have no meaning to them outside of Judaism. I don't know if the other reason why, and you were right, and I went back and said, you're right, those are particularly Jewish arguments in very powerful ways. So that really was a very cool challenge to me. I think that I met the head of the Religious Action Center the following Sunday at the wedding I was doing, and you know, and told about that it was a really good work. I think it was the following his description of where beauty comes from. Okay? But where does beauty come from? So first, this is just sort of an initiation, right? At some point in your life, if you're a Jewish intellectual, somebody will quote Robert Cover 2. Right, and when someone puts Robert Cover 2, you're supposed to not agree and say that was very white. It's fine. Robert Cover actually says all sorts of really cool things. I just got a little bored after a while with every single person calling Robert Cover to me.
Do you just say that was very white?
Yeah, it's one of those things you should recognize the name of Castle Conversations. So when someone brings it up, you say, oh, Robert Cover, very white.
Because someone like quotes Stephen Hawking to take the reaction to
you. Yeah.
Okay.
Robert Cover marched around with the year. That would surprise me.
Robert Cover was
a Yale Law School professor who died very young, but wrote a whole bunch of really interesting things about halakha from the perspective of a particular school of American law before he died. But I would think that he was.
Robert Cover?
No, this cover is the Avraham cover.
I know.
And that's after he was...
Well,
Avraham...
He wasn't a rabbi. He was a law professor.
Oh.
Well, there's a very good chance he really does a law professor. Okay. So anyway, right, so here, Friedman quotes Robert Kupfer is saying.
Okay.
We're on page 53 of the Red Edition. I think in both editions, actually.
On the Foundation.
And in the Foundation matched up, yes.
Wait, what? I think it's the same as the Ritz.
Okay, the story behind the term rights is the story of the social contract. The myth, okay, that the social contract, you understand, is always a myth. What we mean by a myth is not something that is not true, but what we mean is a story that organizes the way in which we perceive reality, without regard to whether it's true or not. Okay, whether it's allegorical, right? So, a social contract, the myth of a social contract is, it postulates, free and independent is highly vulnerable beings, right? So the myth of the social contract assumes that once upon a time, every human being lived alone and was unconstrained by any relationship to anybody else. You were yourself. And everybody could do whatever they wanted.
They were no
good. Exactly right. The myth of the social contract assumes, as it were, that every human being evolved separately and has no necessary relationship with anybody else. And then, right, what they do is they voluntarily trade a portion of, right, they're vulnerable because if they don't do anything, somebody else can kill you. Right? So they voluntarily trade a portion of their autonomy for a measure of collective security. Right? So that's, the myth of the social contract is that really autonomy is the, everyone starts with absolute autonomy. But because we recognize that somebody else's autonomy may in practice infringe on my autonomy, for example, they may kill me, which will deprive me entirely of autonomy. So we make a deal in which we each surrender part of our autonomy in order to protect the rest of it. But the only currency we have is autonomy in the social contract. Okay, it's the only currency we have. We can do it in order to prevent harm. That's one social contract method. There's a second social contract method, which we can do it to increase our autonomy in other ways. Like, for example, if we want to travel to the moon, so no one of us is capable of building a rocket ship, so we'll each trade our autonomy in exchange for the ability to build a spaceship or a car.
No, it's an individual.
Which will increase our individual. It will, before I could do 100% of what I was capable to do and wanted, now I can only do 90% of what I'm capable of doing and want. Well, what I'm capable of doing has been increased. So in practice, it might be an increase in my autonomy. Let's say, for example, a very simple example, I want to play baseball. In order to play baseball, I have to join a team. Now, the team is bigger than my autonomy. I can't hit the ball whenever I want. Before, I can hit the ball whenever I want. Now, I can only hit the ball
That's right.
I'm willing to accept that, because otherwise, I can't play baseball. Right? So often, right, a social contract can actually increase autonomy, not just that it can prevent infringement on autonomy, but it can stop people from hitting me over the head with a baseball bat. and it can gain autonomy, because now I can play in the game of baseball, which was impossible. That's right. So I joined the team. And a team can tell me, no, it's not your turn to hit now. Whereas before, somebody told me it's not my turn to hit, I went, what?
Yeah,
that's
if you didn't have that, then it would just be chaotic.
That's right. So a social contract is a reasonable choice. But the premise of social contract theory is that everybody begins with absolute autonomy, and that's really what the only good is. Right? The purpose of a social contract is to maximize autonomy in a pluralistic setting. Yes, John?
So he said when we're babies, we have total autonomy, and by the time we're like five, we don't.
One of the underlying challenges in any political system is to figure out how the deals of the past be binding on the present. Okay, right? If what you have in Dvarim, right, in Parashat Yitzchakim, when Moshe says God is making this covenant not only with those who are present, but with those which are not present, namely your children, how can you accomplish that? How can you make a covenant that's binding on your children? Right, that's a problem in political theory, the problem, why are we bound by the Constitution? Right, in the same way that the parents, and then those of interest are shown, I have the first intro, I haven't actually put the recording up on the website, but I have a share called Why is the Torah Still Binding? Which takes the which takes the various approaches that have been given over the years and in your sources to solving the political problem of how communism can be binding across generations. But every political system has to assume it has a way of being binding on people who did not participate in the original contract. At some point when you achieve majority, there has to be the law of binding upon you before you accept them. Now you can't say when you turn 18, well, I'll just murder people for the next 2 days and then I'll join the covenant. Now, you can't do that. There has to be a way. Like you tied the leg, I'm sorry, I don't want to be an American citizen until I'm 18 and 3 months.
When you're
18, right, you can't, right? Okay. Okay, so the myth makes the collective arrangement the product of individual choice, and thus secondary to the individual, right? So in the rights model, they're always, individual rights come first, and the collective is the product of choices of individuals to join. When you are born, right, you are individual, you are an individual, and then you are socialized, as opposed to you are born a member of a society. And then maybe you grow into individuality, which is the entire different model. Okay, yes, sir.
So this, I think, relates to the school. Like, outside of school, we have a degree of autonomy other than our parents and the law which oversee us, but we have, the right, we can go out and say, kids can drink, even though legally, so then you enter social contract with the school that says that you enter a duty with them, that you can't do that or else they can...
That's right. No, the whole issue that I make a speech with, so what is the social contract? What is the social contract that students enter into when they... Right, how much of your autonomy and what sphere are you surrendering in order to become... In order to gain education? Or to protect yourself from the secular society that was surrounding the public school, depending on your motives are for coming here. Okay, so the myth of the social contract makes the collective arrangement the product of individual choice, and thus secondary to the individual. Rights are the fundamental category because rights is the normative category, or the category that creates rules, which most nearly approximates that which is the source of the legitimacy of everything else. Okay, rights are the way in which autonomy is embodied into law, and basically all value is a product of autonomy, and the whole purpose of autonomy, the whole purpose of all arrangements are to maximize autonomy, either by preventing infringements on it or by creating the possibility for choices that didn't exist previously.
Wow, that's really wise.
Thanks. That's the right model. Okay, however, it says not so, or at least not simply so, for the model of duty. A duty can be acquired by voluntary choice, but its moral force is not exhausted by that choice. Okay, or this is the word. Duty says that you can be bound by things that you did not agree to, right? You can have the obligation to do things, right, which limit, you can have a limitation on your autonomy, which you did not freely assume. Either really in your life or even mythically. Okay, right. For example, right, when you're obeying the law in America, we have a myth that you were somehow part of the consensus at the moment of the founding of the country. Or we have a different myth, which is that there's a constant ongoing vote in the United States to uphold the Constitution. It can move. Right, but as Ezra points out, sibling obligations are not generated that way at all. Sibling obligations just happened. You were born a sibling. You were born a child. And to some degree, you choose to become a parent. Okay, so his framing, which comes sort of the footnote is to just sort of check here. Where is this footnote going? It's again from cover, sorry. So cover says the basic myth of Judaism is obligation or mitzvah. Right, it's the myth of Sinai. So the myth of social contract is a myth of autonomy, and the myth of Sinai is a myth of heteronomy. Okay, autonomy is self-rule, heteronomy is other-rule.
Can you repeat that?
I'm just reading your book.
No, I know, but I mean,
So he says that Judaism does not conceive of obligations as stemming from our choices as individuals. Obligation comes from the fact that we as a community together, right, we're bound by a covenant. The mitzvah comes from Sinai. And so the fact of being Jewish, right, absence, right, without any choice, it's possible for an individual to make the choice to become Jewish. But the vision you have here, and this is funny, this is an ideological vision, because this is, to some degree, explicitly rejected by the Reform movement. Right, when the Reform movement adopted patrilineal defense, what it really said was that Judaism always has to be truly chosen. Right, they really said was that they don't think defense makes you Jews at all, it's always choice, and therefore it shouldn't matter which parents. I don't think that the Reform movement ever actually carried this out in practice. You should be aware of, you know, that because the Reform movement understands itself largely as being a movement that accepts the primacy of autonomy but sees value in Judaism, so it's always had a lot of trouble with this counter vision. And it's really interesting to watch the theologians try and struggle with it, which the best is the Eugene Garlitz, who's seen many of his writings, which are attempts to construct a Reform theology that still for mitzvah.
Well, at the same time, the Reform movement, it also employed other different struggles.
Sure, there are lots of
contradictions in between this.
There are lots of advantages to an autonomy-based system, right? But I just wanted to tell you that when Friedman quotes Tucker as saying this is the dining myth of Judaism, you should be aware that excludes certain visions of Reform from Judaism, although not all. Eric Yaffe would happily quote this language without any difficulty, and so would Eugene Barowitz, but he would give you a really interesting read on it. Yes, Kayla?
Well, just generally, the time of the Mitzvah of Sinai being from innocent isn't chosen. And then before, we're talking about halakha and autonomy, and that conflict with one another, but if halakha is considered to be intrinsically Jewish or relating to Judaism, then don't you have an obligation? But I don't know how to really phrase this. What I'm trying to get at, I guess, is that if it's an experience that isn't chosen, then there can't really be that conflict.
Okay, well, eventually what you're trying to get is, I'll try to challenge this part of what you're trying to get at.
Okay.
Friedman claims that he's going to come up with a model of duty that is relevant to non-Jews. But he's rooting it in a myth which is as particularistic as it gets.
Right.
Right, which is the Jewish way, the Jewish experience of Sinai.
Right.
So that's a challenge he has to overcome. If he claims that... If he claims that Judaism is rooted in a specific myth of Sinai, which relates specifically to Jews, how can he claim that the consequences of this myth,
it's universal, right?
Sinai is a myth that says that your duties do not come from your choice. Your duties come because God... Duties come because God imposed them on you. Okay, he argues that, if you think that you choose and all you have the only reason is rights and what you surrender to your rights, you start off with absolute rights, and that's always the basic thing, but Sinai doesn't think you start off with rights. Sinai thinks you start off with obligations. And rights are only generated by those obligations, not the other way around.
You had a right. You chose whether or not to go to Sinai or not.
That's true, maybe, although, you know, that's all, there are different versions of the sign of it, there's one version. It's not so clear in the Jewish, you know, sorry to say, we even have Sinai, right, that holds it out over you.
We don't know, what is the, what is the myth of Sinai that is trying to overcome?
Okay, so let's see again. And again, when we say myth again, it doesn't mean that he doesn't think it's historically true. He thinks it is historically true. The assumption. The myth of Sinai, the organizing idea that Sinai represents is that a long time ago, the Jews set up, right, the Jews agreed to accept commands, right, the Jews were commanded by God, and, right, that wasn't, they didn't choose what they didn't choose to give up their, you know, the right, they didn't impose the obligation on themselves. God commanded them. And being Jewish imposes those obligations on you whether or not you choose to accept them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's page one. That's a duty-based model. Okay, now what Caleb was asking, as I'm explaining it, is the Friedman also claims that this model is useful for non-Jews. But nobody claims that non-Jews were assigned and accepted these obligations. So how can he claim on the one hand that the model of duty comes from Sinai, and on the other hand, claim that the model of duty is useful to everybody? Okay, that's the challenge he has to overcome. What I think he's going to claim to overcome that is that Sinai is just an example. Right, it's a particular model of claiming that duty comes out of relationship and not out of choice. And the fact of a relationship can create duties even if you didn't choose the relationship.
Isn't that
really
like the doctors and the
patients? Yes, absolutely right.
And
right.
Parents and child.
Right, that's going to be right. Right, the Jews have a particularistic myth about where some of their obligations come from. But what Sinai, the myth of Sinai teaches you is a model in which duty does not stem from choice. Now, the model may tell you that certain duties are generated by choice. But duty in principle is possible without choice. It needs a room. Right now he has to try and negotiate how comprehensive are those duties. Right, that's a different question. But we can be you can't say but it's already in a rights based model. The statement, I never consented, is absolute and always wins. You can't make me do anything unless I said I would. Now, we can say, you said you would in a very elaborate way, right? You know, claiming that you did 10,000 years ago, you know, around a campfire when you were first involved. Or we can do it now. But fundamentally, the only way you can be made to do something is if you said yes. And in a duty-based model, you can say no all you want. If God said yes, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
So,
you haven't even engaged yet. Now, let's go back to that.
Okay. What is it that Friedman is trying to, like, you said Friedman is trying to get you, basically, it's kind of like Friedman said that the model is, like, really, really, kind of, proves that really it's possible.
And non-Jews, it just teaches you that you can conceive of human beings as having duties that are generated by something other than their choice.
Oh, those are not fine.
Okay? Yes, that is what you want to say. Okay.
Yes.
Can
we talk about the model, the rights model, the duty as two completely different possibilities first? Yes. I feel like there are any situations where somehow have to decide it's okay. Like, everyone would agree that they have both rights and duties.
Sure.
So how can you reconcile?
Well, so here's the way, right? You have people who start off by saying that the only issue is autonomy and duty is always secondary to autonomy. You have people who say the issue is always duty, right? And they think that duty always supersedes autonomy. So you have presentations of medical ethics that argue that you never should discuss what the right thing to do is because why should your opinion matter? All you should discuss is who gets to make the decision. You know, presentations of Judaism that say that the only issue is to figure out what God wants, what you want is irrelevant. Right? And those visions, Judaism and autonomy, are really incompatible. Right? So what Friedman's first move is going to be, all you people who think that Judaism has nothing to say, you should understand that you really need duty, because without a conception of duty, you can't have ethical conversations. You know, so an impoverished vocabulary, the only thing you can talk about is who makes decisions. That's not what people want. People want to have conversations. People want everybody in the room, right? If you talk to real people don't just want to know who has to make the decision. Real people want to do the right thing. Right? Real people,
real people don't want to fight with each other right over loved, right, at a loved one's bedside. Real people want to come out together on a joint plan of action that satisfies everyone. So your model of right doesn't really address the needs of people in a hospital situation. That's his argument. So you need Judaism. Because Judaism can give you a language, right, which lets you talk to each other. Okay, but now, then you're going to turn around and say, but you people who present Judaism in that way, that Judaism is all about heteronomy, and has no interest in what, right, and doesn't see the fact that somebody wants to do this, or somebody would make this decision as relevant at all. All that matters is what the right decision is to do. So you have to recognize that that's going to be irrelevant to most, right, that's not going to work. Because while people want to engage in the conversation, right, as Westerners, we start off with the premise that autonomy is of real value. And one of the primary duties that all Americans are going to recognize up front is the duty to respect someone else's autonomy.
Yes.
So unless you can find a way to build the language of autonomy into Judaism, you're going to end up with a system which is only relevant for Jews. And not even for all Jews. It's going to be relevant specifically for a particular band of Orthodox Jews. Okay, so what he's going to try and do is, after he shows you why autonomy is insufficient, and therefore builds in a need for duty, and therefore creates the state for Judaism, he then has to say, but, right, in the way he frames it specifically is that because so much of contemporary medical ethics is built around the concept of informed consent, there has to be a way to give informed consent real value in Jewish terms.
Because, just on that side, there really is no...
So now the question is, can we find language within Judaism that enables us to find space for autonomy within the universe of the duties? Okay, now I contend, and a large part of what I do, a large part of what I do in the realm of medical ethics and in many other areas of Halakha is to try and find the language that enables us, to talk about autonomy. So, for example, I just posted on the internet this week an article that talks about whether there are things that God can ask people to do. Can you make a halakhic argument? Can you make a halakhic argument that certain halakhic conclusions are impossible because God is not allowed to ask those things to people? You can read it. You can find out if you because the tradition is self-enforced principles. This piece is on. Well, there'll be a link to it, the piece is on the blog called Text and Texture. I'll give you an easy model. Okay, there is an obligation that most people generate that say that there's an imperative called the Nishmartem Me'od Nafshecheichem. You have to be exceedingly careful, and the way we understand it traditionally is that you have to be careful to make sure that your soul remains attached to your body. That literally means you have to be exceedingly careful about your soul, the Nafshecheichem, but Halakha understands that we have it as be very careful to make sure your soul stays in your body. That's a duty. Now that duty seems to say that it is halakhically forbidden ever to take risks. Physical risks. So why is it okay with this?
Very careful.
Even very careful doesn't mean
getting to ask. Okay, can I drive? Driving's
really dangerous.
If you're not doing anything, then you're not taking care of your soul. You're just letting it just
run out.
You get a soul like a
prison. Okay, so now William gives us an argument where he says that, you know what, Lane wants to find language for a different kind of duty, right? A duty of self-development. So the argument, you can only take risks when they contribute to your self-development. That's if you have a conflicting duty. Right? But But what is it? That becomes dangerous. Like, if you don't drive and don't come outside, it's too dangerous. You should decide.
Right.
Okay. But my primary calculation is whatever knowledge you show you makes you stronger. If you look at it, anything that you do,
let's suppose I just really like
mountains in my school.
I really like mountain climbing. I really like motorcycle riding. I do like riding a bicycle and a helmet.
I really like.
Now am I allowed to do that?
Halakhically,
isn't it a violation of the Mishmar right now? All right, I could be more careful. Now the question is there a way halakhically to say, but gosh darn it, I like the way it feels, and I have the right to choose something else over my safety, within reason.
Well, you can say the same thing about the dilemma against filters.
Well, that's the risk, right? You know, so what are the boundaries of this? Can I be a coal miner? Even though I know that being a coal miner is almost certainly going to get me out of the game, I like money.
It's more of a...
I like money. Okay. So this is the challenge. What Friedman set out of the chapter originally, right, is he claims that the duty to take care of yourself is modified by, does not eliminate autonomy. It doesn't mean you just have to listen mechanically to doctors. It means you have to be responsible. All right, he tries to create autonomy in that framework. I have argued in a whole set of contexts, and I don't have the evidence for the way I would like it, but I have argued in a whole set of contexts the halakha actually recognizes what I call a right to a normal life. There is a halakhic principle that we will discuss in greater detail. It's called Shomer Tzayin Hashem. God protects the fool. And that is understood halakhically as meaning, right? It's a subject initially. God protects the fool. But halakhically, that is understood to mean that you are allowed to take the risks that your society considers normal. That's an interesting move, right? That God protects you is seen as, and therefore it is not halakhic to treat as risk. If you engage in the same kind of risk that normally you take, so you're allowed to cross the street. Right? One of the debate about smoking revolves, the halakhic debate around smoking in large measure revolves around the question of whether society still considers smoking a normal risk or not.
In the late 1960s, early 1970s,
right, Moshe Feinstein wrote that he could not ban smoking because smoking was a normal social activity, and even though it was dangerous, But it was the kind of risk that society considered normal, and he couldn't ban it. Alright, and people have argued that is no longer operative because social circumstances have changed so that now people look at somebody smoking as, there's that person committing suicide. That's right, as opposed to, there's that person taking irrational risk. Very long,
long run.
Is drinking to excess is a risk, but it tells you to get really, really drunk and bored.
It does not tell you to get really drunk and bored.
I was reading that.
And
on the front page, you would get like a sticker that they put.
Very good.
I'm like, who is it? And it was a really good time to find the right.
I think the best was
I wonder if I'm acting anti-lock, but I don't check, but I do have to call it a little bit, and I will, you know, it's possible that should be prohibited. Okay, please think about your venues, but there is going to be an essay that we'll be doing no later than late Tuesday night.
I'm going to ask you to see them, so I can do that.
It's going to be an essay at some point before 1 minute, which we need to make class, I just haven't figured out how to do it yet.